I was originally asked to speak on the subject, creating a new mindset. That's what the committee told me. They said, talk on creating a new mindset. And I'm not the kind of person that likes the word mindset. I never liked that word. When did you first hear that word, like in the late 70s? I don't like to share the experience, and I don't like to have quality time, and I don't like mindset and things like that. So I said, is that really what you want me to talk on? And they said, yes, we want you to talk on the subject of the book by Paul Lampol called Creating a New Mindset. And I was very happy when I heard that, because Paul Lampol never wrote a book called Creating a New Mindset. Okay. He wrote a book called Creating a New Mind, which is the same thing, pretty much. Wouldn't you agree? So I was very happy. And I went and I read the book by Paul Lampol called Creating a New Mind. And I can tell you right now that there's no way in three sessions that you could cover all the material in that book. It's a brilliant book. How many of you have read it? Okay, so that's very good. How many of you have a new mind since you read that book? How many of you are out of your mind? So, yeah. Okay, good. Okay, even those that hadn't read the book. But in that book, he basically describes three arenas in which change needs to take place in the Baha'i community. And those arenas are the individual, institutions, and the community. And within each of those three, I think he has 12 to 15 chapters in which he describes the various ways in which change must take place in the Baha'i community. I think that if you had 10 or 12 lectures on that, you still couldn't cover the material. So I'm just not going to do it. Rather, I decided to look at the concept of changing your mind in the Baha'i writings to see what the basic principles are and see if we can't come to some method, some easy method that can enable us to have a new mind. You may realize that the whole principle of the Baha'i revelation is transformation and change. If you wanted to just completely summarize what the theme is of the revelation of Baha'u'llah, you could say it's about transformation and change of civilization, of mankind, of culture, of the world. That really is the fundamental principle of the Baha'i faith, is that the world is in need of transformation and change. If you don't believe me, go and look at the very first paragraph of the introduction by Shoghi Effendi to God Passes By. Because if you think about it, God Passes By is Shoghi Effendi's complete history of the whole early part of the Baha'i faith. He had to write an introduction to that. So what is Shoghi Effendi going to say in the introduction to this? And I'm going to read you what Shoghi Effendi says in the introduction to God Passes By. He says, the weight of the potentialities which this faith, possessing no peer or equal in the world's spiritual history, and marking the culmination of a universal prophetic cycle, has been endowed. He says, the weight with which it has been endowed staggers our imagination. Already in the space of less than a century, the operation of the mysterious process generated by its creative spirit has provoked a tumult in human society such as no mind can fathom. It has, through the emergence of its slowly crystallizing system, induced a fermentation in the general life of mankind, designed to shake the very foundations of a disordered society, to purify its lifeblood, to reorient and reconstruct its institutions, to shape its final destiny. Can you believe that? He says that the potentialities of this revelation staggers our imagination. It's induced a fermentation in the general life of mankind. He goes on for three more paragraphs on this theme. He talks about, and I'm not going to read it, he talks about how there has been this worldwide upheaval as a result of the Baha'i revelation, and he says that this planetary upheaval has deranged the equilibrium of the world. He says that there is a world-shaking, world-energizing, world-redeeming spirit that Baha'u'llah brought into the world, and it is, quote, vibrating in the inmost reality of all things. Okay, is that not change and transformation such as the world has never seen? That is the theme. Now, it seems to me that then we each have to figure out how can we change? How similar are we to the human beings that lived on this planet before this revelation, and how much transformation have we gone through ourselves yet? Obviously, we have not fulfilled the kind of transformation that Baha'u'llah wants to see for the world or for us. But Baha'u'llah promises that there is the possibility for you to have a new mind. And I want to read this to you. It's from the Kitab-i-Iqan, and Baha'u'llah says that if you do a few things, actually not a few, it's 25 things, if you want to know, I count them. Okay. But if you do 25 things, and if you want, I can list you the 25, because I counted them. He says, if you do 25 things, and then on top of that, if you are really, really enthusiastic, really enthusiastic, and you do the 25 things, and you're enthusiastic, this is what will happen to you. He says, then will the manifold favors and outpouring grace of the Holy and Everlasting Spirit confer such new life upon that seeker that he will find himself endowed with a new eye, a new heart, and a new mind. He will contemplate the manifest signs of the universe and will penetrate the hidden mysteries of the soul. Gazing with the eye of God, he will perceive within every atom a door that leadeth him to the stations of absolute certitude. He will discover in all things the mysteries of divine revelation and the evidences of an everlasting manifestation. Isn't that an amazing promise? You do these 25 things, you will have a new eye, a new ear, a new heart, a new mind, and you will see in every atom of creation doors that lead to the knowledge of God. This is Baha'u'llah's promise in the Kitab-i-Iqan. Now, how many of you would like to have that new mind that Baha'u'llah is talking about? 1, 2, 3, 4. Good. Okay. So what I want to do is then see if there's a way in which we can develop a path for this, some kind of surefire method. You know, the human soul doesn't come with a user's manual. But actually it does. The user's manual is the hidden words. The user's manual is the Kitab-i-Iqan. It's Baha'u'llah's writings. It does come with the user's manual. How many of you people get something and try to work it and don't read the manual? I'm like, okay, you're all playing. We're all kind of like that. We just want to start doing it. I think that's what pretty much what all of us are doing with our mind and our spirit. We're trying to use it, and we haven't taken time to read the manual. And if you read the manual, you can use it a whole lot better, and maybe you can achieve what Baha'u'llah says here in the Kitab-i-Iqan. So what I want to do is look in the Baha'i writings and see what are the principles for human transformation, personal human transformation. In other words, Paul Lample talked about the individual and the institutions and the community. I'm only going to look at the first part, the individual, and I'm not even going to look like he did at what the things we need to transform to. I only want to look at the process by which we can transform to those things. But before I do this, I want to mention, oh, Darren, I'm glad you're here. Darren's going to have to help me because Darren is a physicist, right? Okay. And I've been talking to him a lot because last year I gave a course pretty much on science and religion, and Darren pointed out all the things that I said wrong last year. So I made sure to... No, that's not true. No, he didn't do that. But he's a physicist, and I want to mention two principles. One comes from physics, and one comes from psychology. Two principles, and I want to mention these first so we understand them, and then I'm going to go to the Baha'i writings. And the reason I mention these two things first is that they very closely correspond to the fundamental principles of change and transformation in the Baha'i writings. The first concept comes from physics, and it has to do with the idea that we only can understand truth, and we can only understand anything if we understand its frame of reference. How many of people have heard the term frame of reference used in physics? If you work in physics or in any branch of the physical sciences, you understand that a frame of reference is required to understand something. Now, if you don't know the frame of reference, then you really can't understand too much. Now, there are many kinds of frames of reference in physics, and I asked Darren last night how many there were, and he said there were countless. Is that what you said to me? So I wanted to mention all of them, and now I can't, because Darren is here. But some of them have to do with things, you're stationary, and nothing is moving. Like, for example, we say, I can't see the forest from the trees. That's stationary, but you can see that when you see the trees, you have one frame of reference where you are, and if you're the forest, you have another one. Others have to do with things that are moving, okay? And as things move, depending on what they're moving, you have a different frame of reference. If I were to hold a bar right up here, like a long bar like this, and you looked at it, you might say it's a big long bar. If you were over here and you looked at it, you might say it's a dot. Would you agree? Because your frame of reference is different. So things are different. Truth is actually different according to your frame of reference. Likewise, if you're moving, say for example, I'm in a convertible car driving 60 miles an hour, I might say that there's wind if I reach outside. Is there wind? From your frame of reference, there is. But what about if you're outside the car? There's no wind. The wind was created by your movement. It depends on your frame of reference. Likewise, if a fly was in a train, let's say you're in a train going at 60 miles an hour, and a fly goes past you at 1 mile an hour, how fast is the fly moving? Okay, well, it's very simple. The fly is moving at 1 mile an hour to the frame of reference of the person sitting on the train. But to the person outside, how fast is the fly moving? 60 miles an hour. But the Earth is spinning. How fast is it spinning? Okay, and then the spinning Earth is rotating, okay, and then the galaxy is rotating, so there's movement upon movement upon movement, and so there's many, many different frames of reference. So Einstein extended this even to time. Time and space even changes according to your frame of reference. Now, we can't go into this. In fact, I think I would like Darren to maybe give a talk on this. That just as in physics or science, that human beings also have frames of reference. And that every human being is right according to their own frame of reference. Nobody is ever wrong. If you sit at the table and talk to somebody and they have some opinion that's different to yours, you must say to yourself immediately, that person is right according to his or her frame of reference. And it's only that their frame of reference differs from mine that we have any difference of idea. Now, it logically follows then that you can't change someone's mind. You can only change their frame of reference, and then the mind actually just follows. Likewise, you can't change yourself unless you change your frame of reference. It's just a very natural thing. And often a frame of reference change can bring about sudden knowledge. For example, the astronauts said that when they first went into space and they looked at the Earth, they just looked at it and suddenly they had a completely different concept of mankind, civilization, history, sociology, psychology, everything in a single image. They didn't read books, they didn't read psychology, anything. Just a single frame of reference change caused dramatic mind change. Would you agree? We all go through this. Now, if you look in the Baha'i writings, you'll find that many times Baha'u'llah, Abdu'l-Baha, or Shoghi Effendi calls us to change our frame of reference rather than telling us exactly what to believe. For example, Baha'u'llah says, let your vision be world-embracing rather than confined to your own self. Notice he didn't say what to believe. He didn't say think this, think that, think this. He just said change your vision. Abdu'l-Baha said, quote, in this wondrous revelation, in this glorious century, the foundations of the faith of God and the distinguishing feature of his law is the consciousness of the oneness of mankind. Now, isn't that interesting that he used the consciousness of the one? In other words, he didn't say oneness of mankind is something you should believe in. He said you have to have a consciousness of it. Is that not a change in your frame of reference that Abdu'l-Bahá is calling. Now, if you become aware of this concept, you will read so much of Shoghi Effendi, so much of Abdu'l-Bahá, and you'll realize that he's calling us to change our perspective, our frame of reference. In fact, we know that if you look at something from a different frame of reference, you can often understand it or solve the problem. Darren told me that in physics, they often purposefully try and find a different frame of reference because one of them will solve the problem and the other one, you can't even understand the problem. Is that correct? Is that what you told me? He said basically that the problem becomes much easier to solve if you change your frame of reference. Now, this is interesting because we're told in Baha'i consultation to try and really understand everyone's opinion. But what you really need to do is put yourself in their frame of reference. And sometimes a solution to a problem will occur to you only when you put themselves in that frame of reference. You know, there's an old saying that says, before criticizing someone, walk a mile in their shoes. Because then, when you do criticize them, they're a mile away from you and you have... and you have their shoes, you see? Okay. which is very, very true. But also, it's just a basic expression of the idea of a change of frame of reference. Many times the arts, literature, drama, theater, will change our frame of reference without actually preaching. In 1862, Abraham Lincoln met the novelist Harriet Beecher Stowe in the White House. And it's been widely reported, although it sounds a little fishy to me, but it's reported in many, many books, that Abraham Lincoln met Harriet Beecher Stowe, and he said, so this is the little lady that started this big war? And the reason is that he knew that she had written the book Uncle Tom's Cabin. And Uncle Tom's Cabin was so influential in the North in changing the attitude towards slavery that Abraham Lincoln blamed the whole Civil War, all 500,000 deaths and everything else. He blamed on this little lady that wrote a book. And yet history, if you read it, you'll find that indeed that book did it. Yet that book was not an essay. It was not a lecture on slavery. It was not a debate. It was not anything. In fact, it only was telling the story of one particular slave. But it so changed the frame of reference that it, according to Abraham Lincoln, started a war and ended slavery. This is how things can happen. Now, I noticed something very interesting in Shoghi Effendi's life. Something Shoghi Effendi did in 1930. Does anyone know what Shoghi Effendi did in 1930? No, he didn't do everything, actually. He did one thing in 1930, and it's not only interesting that he did it, it's when he did it. Okay, in 1930, he writes a letter. He writes a letter actually in March 1931 to Martha Root and says what he's been doing for the last 8 months. And he writes, I have just completed, after 8 months of continuous and hard labor, the translation of the history of the early days of the cause, and sent the manuscript to the American National Assembly. The work comprises about 600 pages, 200 pages of additional notes that I have gleaned during the summer months from different books. I have been so absorbed in this work that I have been forced to delay my correspondence. I am now so tired and exhausted that I can hardly write. The record is an authentic one and deals chiefly with the Bab. Parts of it have been read to Baha'u'llah and revised by Abdu'l-Bahá. I am so overcome with fatigue caused by the long and severe strain of the work I have undertaken that I must now stop and lie down. And what was he talking about? The translation of the book we call the Dawnbreakers. 8 months, night and day, he did this. Now, you'd say, well, what's so interesting about that? The interesting about that is that in that same year, he started to translate the Kitab-i Akan. But apart from that, the Guardian had done nothing else in terms of major book translation, according to Riakanum. Gleanings came later. Prayers and Meditations came later. All of his books, you know, God Passes By, and they all came later. Why did he do the Dawnbreakers first? Why did Shoghi Effendi, and why did he take 8 months nonstop to do it? Furthermore, he didn't even launch any teaching plans until after this. Ryakunim says that, you know, the Shoghi Effendi had to prosecute the tablets of the divine plan. And that was one of his main goals. He didn't do that. So all of the things that you think the guardian had to do, translate all these writings, prosecute teaching plans, first thing he does is he say, before I do any of that, I need to translate the Dawnbreakers. So he does. And then he writes in October of 31, he says, I urge all English-speaking believers to concentrate studying Nabil's immortal narrative as an essential preliminary to the renewed intensive teaching campaign. I strongly feel widespread use of its varied, rich, and authentic material constitutes the most effective weapon to meet the challenge of this critical hour. I unhesitatingly recommend it to every prospective visitor to Baha'u'llah's native land. And Ryakunim then goes on to write, the reason Guardian did this was that he knew he was going to have to call on the believers to do these teaching plans. And he knew that he couldn't do it until they had a change of their frame of reference, which only the Dawnbreakers can give. It's not possible to read the Dawnbreakers without changing your frame of reference in a profound way. Shoghi Effendi was going to call on the believers to sacrifice. But maybe what they thought of sacrifice was that they might, you know, give up a Thursday night to go to a tea and social or something. Maybe that's what they thought sacrifice would have meant. But not when you read the Dawnbreakers. Would you agree? How many of you have read the Dawnbreakers and had a change of frame of reference? Absolutely. So you can see that even in the actions of Shoghi Effendi, he understood the principle that you must have a change in the frame of reference. Now, recently I read an analysis of the work of Albert Einstein. And all of us are familiar that Einstein was just immensely productive. In 1905, he wrote 4 papers that completely revolutionized science. And most people that study his life say his method was based on imagination or visualization or what we call thought experiments, that this was his technique. And they say his technique was based on imagination or visualization. But recently, it has been discovered that Einstein had a very simple technique that he applied to every problem that he discovered. And that technique was that he tried to imagine himself in the frame of reference of some part of what he was thinking about. So if he was thinking about light or gravity, he imagined he was traveling and he was a beam of light or traveling alongside it or something. He tried to put himself in another frame of reference. And when he got there, he saw things in a different way. So definitely changing your frame of reference has an effect. So this is the first principle. You cannot change your mind if you don't change your frame of reference. So we need to know how we can change our frame of reference. The second concept that I want to mention before I go to the Baha'i writings is what we call the concept of inattentional blindness. And this is quite a popular field of study now in psychology. How many of you have read about it at all? Go and look in the internet and type inattentional blindness, particularly in the 90s and now, right now. There's universities all over the world that are conducting studies in this. And basically what they found is that the human being, the human mind or the human perceptional ability, is not as good as we thought. In fact, it's nowhere near as good as we thought. And many things that are very easy to see, we don't see. Very easy to see, we don't see. And we don't see them for various reasons. So actually, there's 3 categories of reasons. But I'll describe to you some of the research that led to understanding. The first research that was done, the first test was done, it was published and it was ridiculed throughout the scientific community because it wasn't believed. Because what he did was he took basketball players, 5 of them, and they passed basketballs and they videotaped it. And the basketball was passing, passing, passing. And he put a group of subjects in front of it and said, count the passes of the basketball players. And they would count 1, 2, 3, 4, maybe 10, 15, 20, 30, I don't know how many. But at some point, as they were counting, a woman in a ballet costume with an umbrella walked in between making sure that she went in front of some, behind the others, and they were still counting the passes. And then he would bring these subjects together and say, how many passes did you count? And someone would say 97 passes or whatever. Did you notice anything unusual? No, I counted 97 passes. You didn't see a woman with an umbrella and ballet costume going through? No. Now, you can get this original video that he showed, and you can see it as clear as can be. It's like, how could you miss that? Consequently, it was assumed that he had falsified his data, or that he had done something wrong, or you know, some way in which it was tainted. And later on, the test was conducted many other times. And one of the most famous tests had to do with a gorilla costume. And you can also see this on the internet. And you can even see the people taking tests. And what they did is they put someone in a gorilla costume, and a really good one. It just looks like even a gorilla would know the difference. It was a really good... Okay. And before they did anything, they said, let's make sure that this is a noticeable thing. So they took the gorilla, person in a gorilla costume, walked it down the street, and everybody noticed it. Cars would stop, they would honk. Even one time they got arrested by the police. The gorilla got arrested by the police. The gorilla said, how fast was I going? I don't know, something like that. Okay. But it was quite obvious that this was a very strange, unusual thing, you know, a gorilla walking around the street. So he makes a video in which he takes a highway that has two or three lanes going this way and two or three lanes going that way. So it's more lanes than both, and a meridian strip down the middle. And the cars are going in both directions, and he plays the video for his subjects. And in the study I saw, they were all university students. And he says, count the cars going along there. Make sure you count every car. One, two, three. And they're counting the cars in both directions. And as they're counting the cars, a gorilla walks completely along the meridian strip. In front of some of the cars they're counting, behind some of the cars they're counting. Now, in this particular test, and you can see it, there's a documentary made on it, they interview these are all university students, and they say, how many cars did you count? And they say, 120, I don't know, whatever they say, how many. Did you notice anything unusual? No, nothing unusual. Now, he'd already shown you the video. It was a gorilla walking up the street. It's so easy to see. And they didn't see it. Every single one of them didn't see it. Usually it's about 70% on statistic don't see it. But in this particular test, everyone didn't see it. So then they say, there was a gorilla that walked, you know, up that street while you were counting the cars. I said, no way. Well, let me play the video. They play the video. Then the person says, I'm sorry, but that is not the video that you showed me. They refuse even to believe it. And other studies have been done in this way, and they found that you are blind to certain things if you are looking at something else. Human perception is not what we think it is. Even though the visual cortex and light and everything that we know about vision, it doesn't get there for some reason. Now, Baha'u'llah constantly refers to the fact that you can't see the spiritual world if you don't not look at the physical world. If you don't, he says, close one eye and open the other. He constantly refers to the principle of inattentional blindness in relation to the physical and spiritual world. But science has found that there are three ways in which you can be blind to truth. One is you can be busy doing something else, and so you miss something. That's the kind that we just talked about. That's one form of inattentional blindness. Another form of inattentional blindness has to do with what you expect. And if something happens that you don't expect, you often don't see it. So they'll do studies where, you know, a certain person will hear the phone ring on a video, and then they'll go and answer it and reach it and answer it, and they say hello, but in fact they switched it, and it's a different person answering the phone. He's got different color hair and different, and 50-60% don't realize, because they don't expect a person as they reach for a phone to transform into another person. Okay, so you don't expect it, you don't see it. They also found that you can become blind if you have knowledge or experience. Knowledge and experience blinds you. Now this is a very strange thing, because we think knowledge and experience makes you better at something. How can knowledge and experience make you blind? Now we know as Baha'is this is true, because Baha'u'llah says, you know, if you want to recognize spiritual truth, you have to empty yourself of all learning. But science has discovered this is the case. And NASA was particularly alarmed when they conducted a test, not too long ago in fact, in which they had space shuttle trained pilots landing in a simulator. In other words, it was just like they were really landing, but it was a simulator. And they were ones that had landed the space shuttle before, experienced NASA space shuttle landing pilots. And they would have them land, but in the simulator, they would put things on the runway that didn't belong there, like people and cars and stuff. And they found that more than a quarter of all the trained NASA pilots landed right on the people or right on the things. Okay, they didn't do it. And then they tried people that weren't experienced at landing, but could taught them to use a simulator, and not one of them landed on the obstructions. And NASA was confused. How could this be so? Our trained pilots don't see something that untrained people do. And this and many other studies have shown that knowledge, experience, or what you expect can cause blindness. Now, we're going to find that this has deep spiritual implications and relates to almost everything that Adibahan Baha'u'llah said. This is why I'm mentioning it. So that's another thing that causes blindness. The third thing that they say causes blindness is gradual change. Gradual change, for some reason, is very hard to see. They do studies in which even over 30 seconds, they'll show a picture. I actually have these on video if you ever want to see them. They show a picture, and over 30 seconds, something will change in the picture, but gradually. A whole building will appear, or a color of something will change, and so on. And usually 50, 60, 70% can't get it if it changes in 30 seconds. Now, if they do the same change instantaneously, you see it immediately. Okay, for some reason, gradual change is hard to see. This is why it's very important that in addition to watching something, you have to take incremental measures of something, once a day or once a year or something, because gradual change is hard to see. All of these three ways show you that human perception is not as good as we think. So we have two ideas here that I want to now relate to the Baha'i writings. One is that frame of reference is the only way that you can change your mind, changing your frame of reference. And two is that perception is dependent on what you do or what you look at. And it's not as good as you think. So, now we're going to talk about how can we change our mind in the light of these two principles, and we're going to actually look at the Baha'i writings. First of all, what is the mind? That's the first thing. We better define it, wouldn't you agree? What is the mind? Now, Adibaha says that the mind is not part of the brain. It's not part of the brain. Now, this is very important because those of you that study biology or medicine or neurology or neuroscience and so on, you're learning from a materialistic society in which they think that the mind is located in the brain. It makes no sense if you think about it, because man is so fundamentally different to the animals in so many ways. There's a whole bundle of things that man can do that animals can't do, and yet there are some animals that have brains quite similar to ours in terms of the physical function. In fact, if you want to know the truth, according to DNA, we're very similar even to plants. Did you know that? We all have shared DNA. In fact, I recently read, it says, that in terms of shared DNA, a human being is 60% the same as a banana. So I read that. And when I first read it, I thought, for sure they're exaggerating, because I know some friends of mine that are not more than 40% bananas. But apparently that's the case. So how could it be that man has all these different things, and yet he has a brain quite similar to other animals, and the animal doesn't have it? There's animals that don't even have 1% of those things, or 10%. There's nothing. So clearly Adibaha must be right if you think about it logically. But he says this: the world of the kingdom is sanctified from everything that can be perceived by the eye or by the other senses, hearing, smell, touch, taste. The mind, which is in man, the existence of which is recognized, where is it? In him. If you examine the body with the eye, the ear, or the other senses, you will not find it. Nevertheless, it exists. Therefore, the mind has no place, but it is connected with the brain. So, it's connected with the brain. This is the reason why science thinks the brain is where mind is, because it's connected with the brain. In fact, I like to think of it kind of like this. The brain is a train station. And some trains come in, and then we see the activity in the train station, but the trains came into the brain from somewhere else. We'll talk about this analogy later. He says, now, concerning mental faculties, they are in truth the inherent properties of the soul. So mind is part of your soul, not part of your brain. And he goes on to explain this. He says that the soul, it cannot be obstructed. It's like a light. If you have a light that's there and it's shining, if I were to put a barrel over it or something, am I hurting the light? I'm only hurting the ability for me to see the light, but I can't hurt the light. In the same way, the soul is like that. Consequently, mind cannot be destroyed. But if the brain is not sound physically, then it's like you're obstructing it, but it's not really hurt. We just lose our ability. Consequently, you can't say someone is out of their mind. You can say they're out of their brain. Okay, if you understand what I'm talking about. And there's some people in this room that I'm thinking about as I say that. Okay. Now, Adabaha makes an analogy. He says that the best way to think of spirit and mind is to think of light and rays. He says the soul or the spirit is the lamp, and the rays are the mind. Okay, one thing is the essence and the other is the emanation. He says, mind is the power of the human spirit. Spirit is the lamp. Mind is the light which shines from the lamp. And then he makes another analogy. Spirit is the tree and mind is the fruit. So mind is the essential emanation of the spirit. Now you say, is there a difference between soul and spirit? Is there a difference? And here's what Adabaha says. He says, the human spirit, which distinguishes man from the animal, is the rational soul. And these two names, the human spirit and the rational soul, designate one thing. So there's just one thing. It's your spirit or your soul. It's like the sun or a lamp. It emanates mind. Mind somehow connects to the brain. And we're going to talk about how it... Do you know how it connects to the brain? We'll talk about that, because it has a connection. And so now we know what mind is, and this is the thing we want to change. Now, what is the first principle, the first frame of reference that Baha'u'llah wants us to have? If he wants you to view creation, what is the primary way in which he wants you to view creation? Yeah, I'm talking about a particular frame of reference. Not bad, but... Yes. Well, that's how we see the physical world. But I'm talking about a spiritual frame of reference. I'll tell you what it is. It is that there are two worlds. There is a physical world and a spiritual world. And you will find this theme so fundamentally embedded in every statement of Baha'u'llah's that there are two worlds. There's a physical world and there's a spiritual world. And he always refers to them both. First example, in one of the hidden words, he says, didst thou behold immortal sovereignty, thou wouldst strive to pass from this fleeting world. So he says there's these two different worlds. And then he says, but to show you one and conceal the other is a mystery which none but the pure in heart can comprehend. And he's basically admitting that there's this great shell game of God that's being played here, in which he's hiding one thing and showing you another. And he's just outrightly admitting that he's faking you out. That's what he's, isn't he? He says, there's one world here and there's another world where I'm going to show you one and I'm going to hide the other. And the reason, it can only be understood if you're pure in heart. So who understands the reason for it? Okay. Now, every time Baha'u'llah refers to creation, he always itemizes the two worlds. Have you noticed that? He never mentions this world, unless he's talking about one in particular, but if he's talking about all creation. Complete these phrases for me. The kingdoms of earth, this world and... or this world and the world to come. All that is heaven and all that is on. The seen and the all things visible and... How many of these could you find? I challenge you to go to the writings and find how creative Baha'u'llah is in having dozens and dozens of different ways, but always itemizing the two worlds, as if to draw your attention, there are two worlds. Baha'u'llah always itemized two worlds, and the Bab always itemized three. Don't ask me why. The Bab always said this world, the heaven and earth and everything that lieth between them. The Bab was a three-world guy, Baha'u'llah was a two-world guy. Now, my guess is that when the Bab was active, there was a lot of action between the two worlds, like the concourse on high and the angels and the cohorts who may are between, and maybe he had to, you know, they said, can you give us a mention too, you know, or something. I don't know. But Baha'u'llah always refers to two worlds. Now, he is so creative. He talks about the physical world, the contingent world, the world that perisheth, this dust heap, this prison, this fleeting world. You know how many different terms he has for that side? Let's call it that side. Okay, on this side, it's the rose garden of the spirit. It's everlasting dominion. It's celestial sovereignty. It's immortal sovereignty. It's the placeless. It's the realms of holiness. It's the celestial paradise. It's the garden of eternal delight. We don't, like Christians, we just have heaven. Okay? We have so many words. I actually would love if somebody would go in the writings and give me all the words on this side and all the words on that side. You know, we just have so many. Baha'u'llah is so creative in referring to the two worlds. But we know that there is a frame of reference that only sees one world. And there's some kind of a mystery involved in why he gives us one frame of reference and says, now try and change your frame of reference. This is your test. I'm going to put you into one frame of reference, and it's a trick. It's a trick. Now, he says in the hidden words, close one eye and open the other. Close one eye to the world and open to this one. Is that not basically just saying, stop counting the cars and look at the gorilla? He could have said that, oh, son of whatever. Stop counting the cars and look at the gorilla. He could have said the same thing. Because basically psychology has proven that sometimes you don't see something that's very easy to see. Remember, it's easy to see the gorilla. This is not a hard thing to see. It's just that you're looking at something else. And Baha'u'llah expresses the same principle by saying, close one eye and look at the gorilla. Okay, don't say that. I'm going to say that. Okay, so we have a hidden word, and it's the number one hidden word in the Persian. And it says, O mystic nightingale, the first call of the beloved is this. Now, I'm always interested whenever Baha'u'llah says, this is the first thing you should do, because I'm very mechanistic in my thought process. I want to know what to do first, second, third, fourth. So when Baha'u'llah says, my first call is to do something, I'm interested. So he says, in the first hidden word, the first hidden word, and he says, this is my first thing that you need to do. He says, oh, a mystic nightingale, abide not but in the rose garden of the spirit. Okay, isn't that this one over here? That's the world over here. So basically he's saying, the first thing you got to do is you got to be over here. You got to live in the rose garden of the spirit. I want you to imagine for a moment that you enroll in a school. And you've never been to the school before, first time, and you go the very first day and you go to a registrar. And the registrar says to you, your homeroom is 47B, you need to go there. That's all you're told. And what is the only thing you're going to ask? Only one question. It is, where is room 47B and how do I get there? There's no other question you need to ask. When you get to that homeroom, then everything will be explained. If I have to be there in 47B, just where is it and how do I get there? Very simple question. Now, Baha'u'llah says, O mystic nightingale, go to room 47B. Okay, he says, abide not but in the rose garden of spirit. He doesn't just say, go to room 47B. He says, don't go anywhere but 47B. Okay, so let's say you go to this registrar, they say that, and you walk out, and you look around, and you don't immediately see 47B. You look for signs, you don't see any signs. You look over here, you look at there, and then you notice over there that there's another room, And it's 27B, but it's a big building. And you hear a lot of noise, a lot of excitement, a lot of laughter, and it looks really fun, room 27B. And when you look, you hear music, and the people are dancing and having a party, and you can smell food coming from it, and you say, well, maybe I should go to 27B and check that one out. But you say, no, he said I have to go to 47B. So you go back to the registrar, and you say, you know, I looked around, and I couldn't see 47B. Are you sure that's where I have to go? And he says, yes, yes, yes. He says, but how come there's no sign to 47B, but there's plenty of signs showing me how to get to 27B? And the registrar says, well, that's a mystery that only the pure in heart can comprehend. And you say, well, thanks a lot. And he says, but you can see it. You can see it. You only need two qualities. You only need two qualities to see it. And Baha'u'llah constantly refers to these two qualities. And those two qualities are eagerness and enthusiasm in your search. And we'll come to that. So he says you need two qualities. So you go out. Now, you go out and probably, if you're like most people, you say, well, you know, let's just, you know, check out 27B. So you go check out 27B and it's a lot of fun, you know, and you enjoy it. And perhaps you just stay there. And time passes, and the whole 4 years goes by, and it comes time for your exam, and you don't know anything on the exam because you spent the whole time in room 27B. Now, this is just an analogy. But basically, Baha'u'llah says, you need to go here, and you don't need to go there. And we need to say, okay, Baha'u'llah, if I need to go there and I don't need to go here, can you just tell me where is it? And how can I get there? That's really what we need to do. How much time do I have? 10 more minutes. Okay. So basically then, I want to see if we can understand what is the difference between room 47B and 27B. I made those up, those room numbers. It's not in the Baha'i writings anywhere to my knowledge. But I want to say, what is the difference between the two worlds? Which side is my good world and my bad world? Is this my bad world? This is the bad world. Okay. So let's first of all talk about what are the characteristics, what are the qualities of this world that we can see. Okay, and I go through the writings and I collect them, and then anything that mentions the contingent world, the world of being, the physical world, you know, and so on, I see what qualities he ascribes to that, and we make a list. I'm going to just list them first, and then we'll go into more detail. He says that the physical world is not reality. It's not reality. Now, this is hard to accept because there's two worlds. There's the real world and the not real world. And the one we think is real is the not real, and the one we're not sure is real is the real one. It's not reality. It's phony. It's made up. It's a construct. It's like a little play that somebody wrote or a little acting out. We don't realize that it's not reality until we die. But Muhammad once said, this world is but a dream. We awaken upon death. And how many of you are familiar with that strange experience when you first wake up from a dream? When you were in the dream, you thought it was reality. And then you have that sudden moment, oh, it was but a dream. Okay. And this is what death is. Death is the realization that life was but a dream. Okay, so the first principle is that it's not reality. The second principle is that it is illusory. It's an illusion. We'll talk about this later. The third property is that it is fleeting. If you do a search on fleeting in this world, I think you'll find maybe hundreds. The world, it passes quickly. Another principle of this physical world is that it's valueless and insignificant. Each one of these categories, basically, I took a quote and I said, well, that goes in that category, until I had maybe 20, 30 quotes for each of these. So, it's not reality, it's illusory, it's fleeting, it's valueless and insignificant. The next one is it's vain. He uses the word vain all the time, or vanity, the world and all its vanities. And of course, as you know, vain means that it has an exaggerated sense of its own importance. It thinks it's more important than it is. The world has vanity. The next principle is that it is a symbolic representation of the spiritual world. Now, last year, we had a whole two subjects on this, and I'm going to draw on some of that information in this talk, but I'm not going to give the two talks I gave last year. However, there will be some things I'm going to say in this talk that won't make sense if you did. How many were here last year? Okay, so the majority. Those of you that were not here last year, you won't understand a lot of what I say in this talk. But Don said that he can make available the two talks that were given last year. And so some of the things I say now won't make any sense, but then if you listen to those talks, it'll make sense later. But basically, this is a very important principle, that the physical world, while it's not reality, it's illusory, it's fleeting, it's valueless, insignificant, it's vain, it also is a representation of this world. It has a symbolic relationship. And the last thing that I find about the physical world is that time spent here is latent with opportunity. Even though it's valueless, insignificant, the time that we spend here has certain opportunities, potentialities that will not come again. And we can talk about that. We'll read that. So now let's look at a few quotations from the writings that support each of these categories. First of all, let's take the idea that the physical world is not reality. Abdu'l-Bahá says, life is of two kinds, that of the body and that of the spirit. The life of the body is material life. The life of the spirit expresses the existence of the kingdom. And whenever he says the kingdom with a capital K, he's not talking about Disneyland. He's talking about the spiritual world. That's another term, the Apa kingdom. I mean, there's so many terms. So he says there's two kinds of life, the physical and the kingdom, in this case. Okay, he says, although the material life has existence, it is pure non-existence and absolute death for holy saints. So, man exists and this stone exists, but what a difference between the existence of man and that stone. Though the stone exists, in relation to man, it is non-existent. So the physical world kind of exists, but in relation to that world, it might as well be a stone to man. Okay. You know, some totally inanimate thing. He often refers to stones in the physical world as things that have no life. He talks about bringing stones to life and so on. Everything in the physical world, Abdu'l-Bahá, has a role for it to play in the spiritual world. And even stones have it. It's very interesting. Now, would you agree then, from what Abdu'l-Bahá said, that this world is not real? Okay, let's take illusory, or it's an illusion. This is Baha'u'lláh in Gleanings. He says, the world is but a show, vain and empty, a mere nothing, bearing the semblance of reality. Now, the interesting thing there is he got all six of the qualities in one sentence. It's but a show, vain, empty, bearing the semblance, which is symbolism. He got it all in one line. He says, verily I say, the world is like a vapor in a desert, which the thirsty dreameth to be water, and striveth after it with all his might, until he cometh unto it, and findeth it to be mere illusion. This physical world is mere illusion. Okay, let's take the next quality of this world. It's valueless and insignificant. I put those in the two things. And for example, we can see this in the Epistle of the Son of the Wolf, in which Baha'u'llah says, in the estimation of the people of Baha, the whole world is worth as much as the black eye of a dead ant. Now, when I first read this, if it was not Baha'u'llah, I would accuse the writer of hyperbole, in other words, of exaggerating. Surely you don't have to go that far. An ant is pretty small and insignificant, okay? So that would be enough. But no, he has to take the eye of the ant, just the eye. But then he has to kill the ant. He says, the black eye of the dead ant. As if to say, is that insignificant enough for you? Isn't that amazing? Now, we can't accuse Baha'u'llah of exaggeration, can we? in relation to the physical world, he says, the whole world in the estimation of the people of Baha is worth as much as the black eye of a dead ant. Now, if I go outside and find a dead ant, take the black eye and give it to you, how much value would you place in that? Okay, would you say it's worth as much as your house and your car and all your clothing and everything? According to Baha'u'llah, yeah. So we can go out and collect some dead ants later and say that's we've got all the wealth of the world in that. Valueless and insignificant, according to Baha'u'llah. The next principle is that the physical world is a symbolic representation of the spiritual world. I talked about this last year, so I don't want to mention it now. But basically, it's that everything in the physical world has a spiritual counterpart. Everything. He says every atom in existence reflecteth some part of the spiritual world. So just as there are rivers, there are spiritual rivers. Just as there are physical mountains, there are spiritual mountains. Just as and so on. Just take all of physical creation, and you will find that the manifestation of God constantly uses analogies from the physical world to explain a spiritual principle. Even the relationships that occur between physical things, they have a spiritual counterpart. So the physical world, while it has no value, it's an illusion, it's fleet. Oh, I didn't even do fleeting. You want to do fleeting as well? Okay. Fleeting is a very interesting one because it's probably the largest category. When I started categorizing all the features of this world over here, fleeting came up more. Fleeting or some other. Swiftly fading, fastly disappearing, evanescent. You know, there's many words that I put in the fleeting category. And why does he constantly tell you this? Furthermore, he says that if you can get a frame of reference that the world is fleeting, you will very quickly change. He says, wert thou to consider this world and realize how fleeting are the things that pertain unto it, thou wouldst choose to tread no path except the path of service to the cause of God. Now, this is interesting because he's saying if you have a different frame of reference in relation to this world, you will do something different. He doesn't say, go and serve the cause. He says, rather, try and change your frame of reference to realize how fleeting it is. I remember Hand of the Cause, John Robarts, he always used to say in his talks, he would say, this world is like a bird flying through a banquet hall in which it goes in one window, it has enough time to grab a little bit of food on the table and it goes out the other window. And that's basically what he has. Now, since we're talking about fleeting, I realize that it's now time to finish because this time has fled. And we'll have two more sessions in which we're going to further describe this world, then we're going to describe that world, and then we're going to see how we can change our own frame of reference. So we'll see you here, same place, after lunch. Thank you very much.